live from our nation's capital.
All talk here in Washington, D.C. turns to President-elect Joe Biden's administration. Historically speaking, the markets have performed better when there is divided government.
The biggest pressure for fiscal stimulus is an uptick in cases.
Bloomberg, sound off. The insiders, the influencers, the insights.
Biden has promised again and again that he will unite the country. State governments control elections. That's in the Constitution.
I think that we can expect a smooth, thoughtful, methodical transition.
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg Radio.
An update on fiscal stimulus talks. This is Gary Cohn is shrugging off Goldman's demand for pay with check to charity. And McConnell signals bipartisan relief plan won't get Republican support. We begin tonight with Sound On Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell saying that, well, he's not sure how optimistic folks should be about a bipartisan stimulus deal. Here he is.
I hope our colleagues let Congress deliver more help soon. A lot of Americans simply cannot afford to wait.
Speaker Pelosi is also weighing in on the negotiations, noting that unemployment benefits are set to expire on December 26th.
This is a smaller package. And as I have said, this is not a stimulus package. It's an emergency supplemental to deal with what we have. I think they've made great progress.
Joining us now is Bill Ferries, Bloomberg National Security Editor. Bill, we'll talk about geopolitics in a second, but let's begin with the fiscal stimulus front. What are you hearing in terms of what role the administration is playing in terms of negotiating a fiscal stimulus deal?
Well, Kevin, you know, it's been a pretty rocky past week. It does seem like both sides have been trying to find a way to get to a number, whether it's $908 billion, $916 billion. But it does, you know, the clock is ticking and the progress seems to be slowing at this point. So time is really, you know, there's this goal of getting home in time for the holidays, and Congress doesn't want to miss that. But you have federal government running out of money shortly, and you have this relief bill and really limited days to finish this off.
That's such a great point. The attempt to draw a pandemic relief package hit another roadblock earlier today as Leader McConnell's top lieutenant said that portions of a compromise proposal from a bipartisan group of lawmakers isn't likely going to get backing from a majority of Republicans. The deliverer of the message, Senator John Thune, reading into my Bloomberg terminal right now, who of course is the Senate's number two Republican, said that the group of Republican and Democratic lawmakers trying to forge a compromise likely cannot produce a solution to limiting liability of employers in connection with COVID-19 infections that will satisfy Republicans. Democrats probably won't like it either, he added. So is it back to square one, Bill?
I don't think it's back to square one, unless square one is, you know, you're talking about $908 billion or so. So there is some sort of a starting point that, let's say, 48 hours ago, everyone seemed to think was a good rough place to begin talks. I think when you look at the, you know, you look at the destruction being wrought by COVID around the country now, you look at a lot of states upping their restrictions, I think the pressure is going to get very intense on both sides of the aisle to reach some sort of a deal. I just think it's going to be at the very last minute.
All right, I got to ask you about this story that everybody's been buzzing about. It's the Axios report that says Christine Fang, a woman suspected of being a Chinese spy, worked for several years to gain the confidence of California Congressman Eric Swalwell. Fang worked on one of his campaigns and even helped place an intern in his office. This was before the FBI alerted Swalwell, and he cut ties with Fang. Though House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said today that Swalwell was not compromised, her House adversary, Kevin McCarthy, cast suspicion not only on Swalwell, but also on the Speaker. Take a listen to Congressman Kevin McCarthy. We've got sound on this brewing scandal. Here's Congressman Kevin McCarthy, Republican of California.
He puts the threat of everybody else of what they're talking about as well. Why did she allow him to stay on that committee? And let's hope she does not in the next Congress either.
Bill Ferries, Bloomberg National Security Editor. What do we know about where this story is going?
Well, I think, you know, this is this comes amid really heightened concern about what China is trying to do globally and with the United States. Tensions are obviously high between Washington and Beijing. I think this is going to cause members of Congress on both sides to look very closely at some of these people who work with them, who work with their staffs back home. who helped them with fundraising, as it appears this woman did. I think it shows the need for a lot more vetting. I certainly think that someone who is on the Intelligence Committee should be particularly alert to these kinds of threats. So I think it's going to be a fair question that the Representative Swalwell and Representative Pelosi are going to have to keep addressing if this issue continues to grow.
But what about the protocols that are in place, or what are the protocols that were missed, or what were some of the safeguards that are typically in place that would allow for a member of Congress to miss these types of warnings? Because to some extent, folks are given who are elected officials are given certain protocols and procedures and rights and access to protection that you would expect people in elected office are able to gain. Were there any? Do we know yet if any protocols were missed or any procedures that are and safeguards were not in place, or do we know any of that?
Well, what we do know is that when Congressman Swalwell was given a defensive briefing on the situation, that he says he immediately cut off ties. Listen, you've covered a lot of a long history of issues in Congress. There is often not exactly a Chinese wall between between official business and the campaign work that often goes back, but there is a bit of a barrier there. The staff don't speak necessarily to people on the campaign side, so I think this opens people's eyes to the fact that even if what he's doing in his official business, what he's doing on the committee or here in Washington has all been vetted and cleared, there's, other issues in his campaign life and that have to be looked at. You can't keep those things separate when it comes to national security concerns.
Well, and the idea that this is somehow happening in a vacuum is definitely, I think, questions that a lot of reporters are looking into right now. Was he the only one?
Exactly.
Personally, is where I think the story will ultimately end up. Bill Ferry's other big headlines on the geopolitical front. Trump says Morocco joining Arab states, building Israeli ties. This was a long months of speculation that Morocco would join. But are these countries or are these Arab states going to continue to be in this strengthening of ties with the Israelis in a Biden administration?
Well, it depends on what kind of enticements they have, right? Most of these deals have been reached with the agreement that the U.S. will increase weapons sales. In the case of the UAE, the first country to really go in on one of these deals, they were essentially promised permission to buy F-35, the next generation fighter technology. So we think this deal with Morocco includes some sort of an agreement to buy perhaps some high-technology drones as well. The Biden administration, I think, so far they have generally praised these deals getting reached. I think they're going to put a review on them and see, what kind of strings have been attached. But generally, I think these are the kinds of wins, diplomatic wins, if they hold, that any administration, Republican or Democrat, would have wanted at any time. So I think it's the kind of thing that President Biden, when he takes office, is going to look to build momentum on.
What are you hearing from your sources about some of the first actions that a Secretary Blinken will take once he's at the State Department?
I think the first day he's probably going to be on the phone with key NATO allies to basically say, listen, multilateralism is back. We want to work with you. We don't want to be publicly threatening you or sanctioning you over issues, even where they disagree, for instance, on the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. They want to work together to focus on Russia, to focus on getting Turkey in line. And then I think there's going to be other issues on the foreign policy front, such as, rejoining the World Health Organization and looking to get back into the Paris Climate Change Accord. So I think there's a lot of kind of easy hits for Tony Blinken to make. I think the harder one is going to be how the U.S. And the Biden administration work with Iran to try to get back into compliance with that nuclear deal, and then take it even further. I think that's going to take up a lot of their bandwidth after those first couple days.
Fascinating. And then some brewing developments on the North Korean front as well. Bill Ferry's Bloomberg National Security Editor. Thank you so much for we covered it all there, Bill. We got domestic, Iran. We do it all. Much more coming up next. We check in with Eric Weiner, Bloomberg Markets Live team leader and the author of two new books about Wall Street, What Goes Up, and the shadow market. I'm Kevin Cirilli. You're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
My name is Kevin Cirilli. I'm the chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. President-elect Joe Biden facing pressure from dueling factions as he gets close to naming people to carry out his environmental policies. Traditionalists who are pushing experienced hands and activists eager for fresh thinking. Coming up in the next hour, we will dive into that tension and explore the dynamics of the Democratic Party as President-elect Joe Biden gets ready to take over Washington, D.C. First, though, let's get a check on the market. Stocks were mixed as traders assessed prospects for fresh stimulus amid the most intense negotiations since Election Day. The S&P 500 came off session lows while still posting back-to-back losses. The NASDAQ 100 rebounded from Wednesday's sell-off, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average underperformed. Airbnb more than doubled in its trading debut. Joining us now on the telephone line, Eric Weiner, Bloomberg Markets Live Team Leader and the author of two books about Wall Street. The first, What Goes Up, and the second, The Shadow Market. I love interviewing authors. I'm fascinated and hope to one day be one. Eric, let me ask you, what happened in the markets today?
Well, you nailed it with Airbnb. It was an interesting day because, you know, the day starts off with the really bad jobless claims numbers, and you would think that everything's going to go down. But as soon as that came in, we all started thinking it's going to actually cause a rally because this will spark traders to think that Washington will respond with stimulus. So you have this weird market where bad things happen, but it's actually good news. The new issues, IPOs like Airbnb, are coming into the greatest environment they've ever seen. They're rising like mania. And, you know, in the meantime, where the news should be bad and you would think that things would take wind out of the stocks, they keep going up or at least stay flat.
I'm just glad you didn't say bad things happen in Philadelphia, because I feel like where I grew up has taken a real beating this year because of some of those political comments. You mentioned Airbnb. Let's explore Airbnb, because we've got Sound On Airbnb, and Airbnb CEO Brian Chesky spoke with Emily Chang earlier this morning ahead of the much-anticipated Airbnb trading day, and she asked Brian why the company is going public now amid a pandemic.
We were prepared to go public this year. And then when the pandemic broke out, we put the S-1 on hold. And I could never have imagined us going public this year when it was April or May. And then something pretty remarkable happened. People this summer, after having been kind of locked in their homes, sheltering in place, wanted to get outside, but they didn't want to travel far. So they started getting in their cars and they started staying in Airbnb. And at that moment, it became really clear that this business model is incredibly resilient, and that our hosts can adapt to really any changing travel behaviors. And it was that point that we thought, you know, we actually have a shot this year.
You know, it's Eric Weiner, Bloomberg Markets Live Team Leader. I found that part of the interview incredibly revealing. And great journalism by Emily Chang, who, of course, is such a rock star in San Francisco, just does such a great job out there in San Francisco. And but it was very revealing, because here's a CEO, Brian Chesky, who said that their company, I don't want to use the word benefited, but their company were able to position themselves in the year of 2020 and make new consumer patterns. I mean, this is a rare instance of not really rare. I mean, you look at Zoom, for example, you look at Home Depot and mm-hmm. all of these other sort of gauge businesses that have come out here. But I think this is probably one of the most solid examples that we've seen, Eric. I mean, would they have had such a high valuation, for example, if they went public not in the pandemic?
Well, it is interesting because what he's saying is right, that they did show a level of durability that, say, DoorDash, which was yesterday's big IPO, hasn't necessarily shown. There's a big difference between what Airbnb does and like delivering food. So you're able to see that Airbnb is a viable business. That all being said, one of the things that I wonder about is how they need cash. Because you would think that regardless of how durable it's been, there hasn't been as much travel as there was. So invariably, you would think that their business has gone down a bit. Right now is probably the best time to go public since the 1990 dot-com boom. We have never had a more welcome environment for new issues than we have right now. So what you're seeing, I mean, as soon as we saw what the deal was priced at, we were thinking, okay, this will get 50% more, and it went 100% more. It's basically a license to print money at this point. So if you're a company, and these windows don't last forever, so if you're a company like Airbnb, and you're thinking, well, actually, we did show that we can make money or we can survive during, a pandemic, and this is the greatest time to go public ever, why not hit the IPO market? The bigger one is DoorDash, like where you're looking at something where, I just don't get that business model. But Airbnb is a real company, and they're going to be around for a while.
I'm not going to make a joke. You mentioned the word boom, and you compared it to, of course, the late 1990s. My mind goes, and I'm an optimist, but my mind goes to, okay, well, does that mean we're going to have a bust in a couple of years?
You invariably do. I mean, we did Cameron Kreis, who's on our team and yeah. does the Macroman column. He did a great column today describing kind of what happens after these things reach their peak, and it's ugly. But that's kind of the way markets work. I mean,
I
eventually,
need some optimism.
You kind of.
Yeah, I can't end this year like this. I can't end this year like this,
well,
Eric.
So the point is, though, that you eventually will find a level. But right now, it's, everybody is, like, dying to get into these things. So you're going to have some overenthusiasm. The bigger question is how quickly we get our vaccines and how quickly we get things back to normal, because in that sense, the market may be set to really run.
Okay, so rough news cycle on the fiscal stimulus front, even as vaccines continue to get ready, but the fate of this fiscal stimulus really being wrapped up today, what would happen if there isn't fiscal stimulus but before the end of the year? How would the markets react? Is that priced in?
Yes, it's priced in. But I also think that
so failure – wait, I just want to be clear here. Failure, because I asked a wordy question. Is failure to get stimulus priced in?
Not exactly, but okay. I don't think that you will see the degree of disappointment that people are kind of expecting.
Why?
Because there are things that the Fed can do in the meantime, but technical things in terms of buying, it's the types of bonds that it buys in order to stimulate the economy a little bit. And then when Biden comes in, there's thought that, they'll finally get something done. The market appears to be pretty optimistic just sort of about the whole idea of getting through to the next stage. And I don't necessarily think that that's unwarranted. Because if you're able to do something in the next few weeks, even so, let's say it goes past into January, if you're able to get things done in a few weeks after that, you still have time. And the economy has not collapsed.
Okay.
Things are not great, but it's not terrible.
Understood. Eric Weiner, Bloomberg Markets Live team leader and author of two new books about Wall Street, What Goes Up and The Shadow Market. Quick question for you. When and where did you find time to write these books?
Oh, well, the first one it was basically the love of my life, and that took 5 years. And the next one I went to a barn up in the Berkshires and wrote in 2 years.
Amazing. While you still worked or no?
The second one I was working during. The first one I was on and off working.
Okay.
It's You know, writing a book, you don't do it for money, you do it for the love. And like you look at it up on your shelf and you're very proud of it and all. And it's all the experience of doing it.
All right, we'll leave it there. Eric Weiner, much more coming up next. This is Bloomberg 99.1.
Live from our nation's capital.
All talk here in Washington, D.C. turns to President-elect Joe Biden's administration.
Historically speaking, the markets have performed better when there is divided government.
The biggest pressure for fiscal stimulus is an uptick in cases.
Bloomberg, sound on. The insiders, the influencers, the insights.
Biden has promised again and again that he will unite the country. State governments control elections. That's in the Constitution.
I think that we can expect a smooth, thoughtful, methodical transition.
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg Radio.
Fiscal stimulus talks hit a hurdle, but is there still optimism? Lots to get through, and President-elect Joe Biden finding himself facing pressure from dueling factions of the Democratic Party on the energy front. We are on full watch regarding regulations and approval of the vaccine. And of course, we'll bring you any breaking developments that happen this hour. But we begin tonight with the big story, fiscal stimulus talks stalling. And we've got sound on that particular issue coming from Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell.
I hope our colleagues let Congress deliver more help soon. A lot of Americans simply cannot afford to wait.
Meanwhile, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi urging lawmakers to come up with some type of compromise on the relief bill before unemployment benefits run out for millions of Americans. Those unemployment benefits are set to expire December 26th.
This is a smaller package. And as I have said, this is not a stimulus package. It's an emergency supplemental to deal with what we have. I think they've made great progress.
We've got a great panel for the hour. Incredibly grateful for both of them. James Homan, national political correspondent for The Washington Post, and recently promoted to being a columnist. James, when does the new column start?
Right after the inauguration.
All right. Congratulations. Until then, he is still the author of The Daily 202. And my friend, Greta Van Susteren, chief national political analyst for Gray Media and host of Full Court Press with Greta Van Susteren. Greta, they still don't have a deal.
Yeah, you know what? And I'm not really happy about this, mainly because I think it's really a terrible thing that Congress has done to the American people on this. They have known for months and months and months, well before the election, that these unemployment benefits are going to run out and all the problems that the American people are going to have. And, they may think, well, the benefits have not yet run out yet. But if you don't have any money or you're worried about money in October, you want to have some level of planning. And instead, they all went home and campaigned. I really think they let the American people down. And so I'm, on both sides of the aisle, and they're fighting over a lot of stupid stuff when the rest of the American people are trying to figure out how to navigate their lives and navigate during this virus. And, you know, the Republicans say it's the Democrats say it's the Republicans, but they both, when they campaigned, they said they can get it done. And yes, it's tough, it's hard to do, and yes, the other side is always obstructions, but, you know, when they asked for our votes, they said they can get it done. Well, they didn't get it done. And so I'm not very sympathetic, and they better do it soon.
Well said. You know, James Homan, what happened? Because here I am. I'm an optimist. And you know, we've been covering this story throughout the past couple of weeks, and there appear to be major signs of progress. And even in talking to lawmakers over the past couple of days, there still appeared optimism, even as early as this morning. So is there still optimism, or is this just dead and gone?
It's not dead and gone, Kevin. I think, you know, a lot
Thank
of times,
you, James.
You know, as well as anyone, you know, as well as anyone that, you know, it can always look darkest before the dawn on these deal negotiations. And, you know, I think both parties recognize the anger that's out there. I thought Greta articulated that so well. I share it. And that's why that sound we heard from McConnell and Pelosi was both, you know, both of them were saying, let's just get this done. They realized that's what everyone wants to do. I think sometimes that can end up getting a deal across the finish line, even if it ends up being a relatively small one where they end up paring down and taking out some of the things both sides want. But the pain is so high. To answer your question of how did we get here, you know, right before the election, Steve Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, was offering basically a $2 trillion package. But Pelosi believed Democrats are going to expand their majority in the House. that they could very realistically win control of the Senate and that they would win the White House. And so Democrats did believe they'd have more leverage after the election, and they didn't do as well as they had hoped, especially in the House. And so now we're talking about something that's much smaller than what was on the table before the election. And it's, you know, in some ways, I think it's a miscalculation by leaders in both parties. And, you know, one of the sticking points several months ago was liability protections. That was something that McConnell described repeatedly in the early summer as a red line. And that's still one of the big holdups at the end here. So, you know, I think there are still some reasons for optimism, but there is, especially at the staff level, at this hour, a lot of backbiting and blame going around.
It's just remarkable. Go ahead, Greta.
Can I add one other thing? And just think the outrage is that while Americans are worried about their jobs in October, but they're really and for good reason is that the Congress is getting paid by them. They're getting their money. They're getting their salaries, and they're campaigning to keep their jobs when they haven't done their jobs. And as for liability protection, I'm a lawyer. I tried cases. I did personal injury cases. Is that if I don't know why McConnell was so hung up on that? All they had to do was change the standard of the burden of proof from just to make it a little bit harder, like clear and convincing or something. They didn't have to go to beyond a reasonable doubt. But you know, there were so many other solutions, and it is appalling to me. And Pelosi, if Pelosi thought that was you know, that she wanted to get more, well, what she should have done is do the targeted one that the Republicans want so people got something. Then she should have gone out and campaigned, and then she should have tried to get a bigger majority, and then they could do other bills.
Or why not?
There's nothing to protect them from getting more bills.
But go ahead, James.
Yeah, to Greta's point, I think that's so true and so smart. You know, and I have heard from so many moderate House Democrats who feel exactly the same way. There are a bunch of members who lost their seats because of Pelosi's tactics, and they are quite frustrated with Democratic leadership for not doing what Greta just said, which is pass a bill so that they could tell their constituents, look, we got a couple hundred billion, you know, we're going to come back and we're going to get more. But instead, by holding out for the bigger deal, voters ended up and punishing them in a lot of these districts that they had picked up in the 2018 midterm.
Well, and also it diminishes the chances of in a couple of months, the Biden administration being able to pass another round of economic stimulus, because more time would have gone by had Speaker Pelosi done that. I mean, what I'm hearing from both of you is really matching with my reporting from talking to lawmakers and whatnot, is that this was a miscalculation from some of the upper echelons of leadership on both sides, but in particular, a miscalculation on Speaker Pelosi's part.
But you say miscalculation, and you know that's such a nice thing to say.
I know. I'm a nice guy, Greta.
I mean, you're a very nice guy, Kevin. That's why, because you know I am so appalled at this.
So am I.
In my wild, if I were a member of Congress and I acted like this when people were hungry, and we have bread lines. When I was a kid, my father used to tell me about during the Depression, they have grown men standing in line to get food for their family crying. And now in my lifetime, we've got the same size bread lines. I mean, it's incredible. And well, so these people are sort of miscalculating and doing things. I know, to me, if I were a member of Congress and I were acting like this, I think my parents would have a stroke.
Or you get coal in your stocking, at least. And James and Greta, I mean, one of the privileges of having you both on the program is that you both never forgot where you came from either. So I think a lot of folks in our industry maybe should get out. I mean, I don't know where they're working from these days, but need a healthy dose of that perspective. All right, panel's going to stay with me. We've got a lot to get through. I'm obsessed with this Chinese spy story. I don't know if you've been following it. I know Greta and James have. But this Chinese spy story is remarkable. I want to know, are there other Chinese spies who have infiltrated and penetrated Congress? Lots to get through. First, though, that's coming up next. Wow, I just did the toss at the top of the show to my good friend Nancy Lyons, and I meant to go to break. Think I need coffee? I'm Kevin Cirilli. You're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.
This is Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
I'm Kevin Cirilli, Chief Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. We're on full watch for whether or not that vaccine gets approved. Regulators have been meeting
all day. All day they've been meeting to see if that U.S. if the vaccine is going to get approved in the United States, as it has in the United Kingdom. But there's this other story that's brewing that could have implications for how committees in the new Congress are going to be investigating the incoming administration. And it's a real interesting topic. A new report from Axios says Christine Fang, a woman suspected of being a Chinese spy, worked for several years to gain the confidence of California Congressman Eric Swalwell. Fang worked on one of his campaigns and even helped place an intern in his office before the FBI alerted Swalwell and he cut ties with Fang. Though House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said earlier today that Swalwell was not compromised, her House adversary, Kevin McCarthy, cast suspicion not only on Swalwell, but also on the speaker.
He puts the threat of everybody else of what they're talking about as well. Why did she allow him to stay on that committee? And let's hope she does not in the next Congress either.
All right, Greta Van Susteren's still with me, and James Homan is with me as well. James is the author of The Daily 202 at The Washington Post, and he's going to become a columnist in the new after President-elect Biden gets sworn in. A huge, huge deal for Washington, D.C., and James's voice, incredibly important in this town. James, but let me begin with you. Before we get the analysis, I want to start with the protocols that are in place for our elected officials to prevent foreign adversary spies from infiltrating national security. So what do we know about that?
This is the tip of the iceberg, and that a lot of our adversaries, and even, frankly, some of our allies, do this kind of thing. And the Chinese and the Russians are particularly aggressive about it. What Eric Swalwell got in 2015 is called a defensive briefing. And that's where the intelligence community, the FBI, tip you off about kind of what's happening so that you can avoid being more compromised. And that kind of thing is somewhat routine. It actually happens more than we know. A lot of times we don't hear about it or report on it. And a lot of this came up in the context of the Russia investigation 4 years ago. There was a lot of criticism for why didn't the FBI give a defensive briefing to Trump during that summer of 2016 to to say, hey, the Russians are trying to compromise your campaign, and the Bureau did not do that, and they didn't brief him until during the transition on some of those threats. And so, the Chinese are the enemy of the future, and so this is going to be something that's more of a problem in the Bay Area, especially a huge Asian population. Culturally much easier to see. Foreign influence.
I raise this point, Greta, respectfully, but it does beg the question, I think, for both Leader McConnell and Speaker Pelosi about the risks and the protocols. And I'm wondering if the political nature that we find ourselves in, as we've seen, as James just outlined, over the past couple of years, whether it's on the right or the left, where foreign adversaries are trying to infiltrate the political process, I'm wondering if there need to be additional protocols and procedures in place.
Well, I don't think you can legislate common sense, so that's a problem.
I agree.
They have a rule on that. But here's a guy, Swalwell, who at one time was running for president and on the House Intel Committee. Now, go figure on that. Now you've got this situation where was this woman just a donor on a campaign, or was there something more to the relationship? If there's something more to the relationship, this is a much deeper problem, not because we've had a lot of infidelities and strange sex scandals in the city, so that wouldn't surprise me. But the idea is that he was a lot cozier to her than just having her work on the campaign. He will not answer that question, has not answered that so far. And then adding to this is that you've got Speaker Pelosi coming out and saying he wasn't compromised. Now, how does she know? What is her source? I guess she talked to him. I don't know. But this is also the same woman who said she was going to win get this huge majority. I mean, in the House. The fact that she comes out and says that he wasn't compromised when we have so little information, he may not have been compromised. He may not have had a cozy relationship with her, but why is his boss and the head of the Democratic Party saying so quickly that he wasn't compromised when it involves China, which is one of our biggest adversaries? You know, have we lost our mind?
No, well, so this is fascinating to me because, James, Greta just really outlined, I think, what a lot of people are thinking right now. But beyond that, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, and again, I say this, we've seen examples in the past few years, whether it's Russia, whether in this case it's China. I don't care if they're a Republican or a Democrat. I don't want spies infiltrating members of Congress. So, James, I mean, from that vantage point, what is the risk that the country faces when these infiltrations move away from how do we prevent this from happening to our entire political system to finger pointing over, well, you know, this particular politician who is in an opposing political party of me messed up? Do you know what I mean?
Well, Kevin, there's a lot of vulnerabilities here. There's a lot of ways that it happens. You know, the enemy doesn't just kind of come after us one particular way. And so, you know, we saw the big FireEye hack that was disclosed earlier this week, likely by the Russian government, to steal the cyber tools at a leading cyber firm. You know, that's a threat. You know, we need to strengthen our foreign agent registration laws and enforcement. The Trump administration has actually done a much better job of enforcing the FARA laws, because we got to know who foreign governments are paying here in D.C. to peddle their agenda. And then, you know, what was going on with this, apparently, Fang woman, is something that is much harder to root out because it's a very long-term play. You know, she wasn't coming in and trying to go right after someone who was, you know, at the CIA. At the point that she was sort of ingratiating herself with Swalwell, and we don't know the extent of their relationship, he wasn't even a member of Congress yet. He was running as a primary candidate against the sitting member of Congress. What happens is, you know, that she's what they call in the espionage business a honeypot. According to the Axios report, she slept with two different mayors from Ohio, and, you know, those guys don't have access to intelligence. But what they're doing is laying the groundwork for these long-term relationships.
All right, we got to leave it there. Coming up next, we head to Capitol Hill, and then I check in to see what's on James and Greta's radar. You don't want to miss that. I'm Kevin Cirilli. You're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.
On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
My name is Kevin Cirilli. I'm the chief Washington correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. If you're feeling a little gray, don't be. It's the end of the year. We're all going to get through it together, and 2020 is over. Our indefatigable team, led, of course, by REP, Christine Barada, one of our producers, Matthew Shirley, giving me a hard time because they've noticed a few gray hairs on my head. And in the break, they were telling me to dye my hair. You see what I put up with? Joining us on the line, Congressman, they didn't think I would say that on air, Congressman Don Beyer, a Democrat from Virginia's 8th Congressional District, representing Virginia's 8th Congressional District. He's also the vice chairman of the Joint Economic Committee, Ways and Means and Trade Subcommittee. Congressman Beyer, welcome back to the program. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Kevin. It's radio, so I can't see your hair.
You know, I know I'm going to get in trouble for that intro, but you know what? You got to live a little, right, Congressman? Right.
Right, exactly.
I can be focused. Okay. My question to you, sir, is, are lawmakers focused on getting a deal? I feel like the talks fell apart today.
Yeah, lawmakers are, except that most of us are not in the room. And yeah, I've read about the deal falling apart, but I've also read that both Speaker Pelosi and Majority Leader Hoyer have said, we're not going home until we get a deal. I think we're still very committed. I mean, just look at what's happened. Well, the stock market today, but even more importantly, the unemployment claims today. You know, there's real concern that there's an awful lot of people hurting. We have to get money to them.
So I think from the outsider's perspective, and in conversations that I've had today and talking with staffers and talking with lawmakers all week, I don't know where things took a turn precisely today. So help me understand that, because there seemed to be such a positive trend of the breakthrough that was happening with this agreement around 908. And now it seems that those talks are just totally I don't know what went wrong.
Kevin, as best I understand it, it was the challenge with getting enough Republican senators to be for it. The problem's never been in the House. We've passed, you know, stimulus and relief bill one after another. But I think Mitch McConnell, who seemingly runs the Senate with an iron fist, also realizes or believes that he has to have the support of a majority of his Republican senators. He didn't want to just pass it with, you know, 47 Democrats and 4 or 5 or 6 Republicans. And that's where the challenge is. And I don't know who to pick on, but I would guess that the Tom Cottons and Ted Cruz's of the world have pushed back.
Congressman Don Byers with us. He is a Democrat representing Virginia's 8th congressional district. He's also the vice chair of the Joint Economic Committee. Congressman, you know this. I mean, and I don't want to push it too far here, but the general consensus that has been widely reported, it meshes with my reporting as well, is that people like yourself are a bit frustrated with leadership, not just Speaker Pelosi individually, but also Republican leadership as well. You said this at the start of the segment, that most of the members aren't able to be in the room. I mean, is just how palpable is that frustration? And do you think that that will lend itself to any political capital in the new Congress?
I think there is a lot of frustration, but I don't think the frustration is with Speaker Pelosi. I think the frustration is always been trying to get something through the Senate. And frankly, Kevin, it's not so much frustration as it is empathy and a sense of the suffering of the huge number of people that have been unemployed for more than 26 weeks, the folks who haven't had an unemployment check since their 26 weeks ran out or since the $600 ended at the end of July. You know, we're not in the room, but I also know that we really want a deal and that we feel like we have to get to it. But Mitch McConnell has to be able to say yes.
Yeah. All right. I want to switch gears now because you are also a member of on the Trade Subcommittee for Ways and Means. And yesterday, President-elect Joe Biden picking longtime China critic Catherine Tai as a top U.S. trade official. Just your reaction to that pick. And what do you hope the Biden administration accomplishes on the U.S.-China trade front? And more broadly speaking, the broader trade issues as well.
Yeah, well, I'm thrilled with Catherine Tai's choice. You know, she's been the lead staff for Ways and Means Trade for a number of years, but she has a great depth. She was a deputy U.S. trade rep before. She speaks fluent Mandarin. She studied in China, and she's just smart and honest, and she'll be terrific. And I think the first thing she'll do is try to make sure that most of the other nations of the world join with us in presenting a solid front in our dealings with China. When we do this America first, America alone, you know, we lose a lot of our allies, and we're going to have to be united with Europe and with those specific nations if we're going to, you know, move our relationship with China forward.
So, I mean, do you think, I mean, and President-elect Biden, we have breaking news, a red headline crossing the Bloomberg terminal now. FDA advisors vote that Pfizer vaccine's benefits outweigh the risk, again, a red headline crossing the Bloomberg terminal right now, that FDA advisors have voted that Pfizer's vaccine's benefits outweigh the risks. I will bring you more as this emerges and we get some more guidance on specifically what this vote will mean. But FDA advisors voting that Pfizer's vaccine benefits outweigh the risks. Congressman, your immediate reaction in terms of the vaccination process here in the United States and where this will move over the coming weeks and months?
Well, I'm thrilled that they do this. Now I'll always be able to say I knew exactly where I was when the Pfizer vaccine was approved on the phone with Kevin Cirilli.
Thank you, Congressman. Hey,
this is a great movement in the right direction. And I'm hoping by May or June, most of us will be vaccinated.
So, I mean, this is an uncomfortable question, but it's one that I've had to ask people like yourself in both parties every single day for the past week or so on this program. One of the top question that I get from folks outside of Washington, D.C. and friends of mine is about whether or not they can trust the vaccine. I say, yes, you can. And you know, when it's your time to get it, you should get it. But from your perspective, Congressman, these aren't anti-vaxxers who are asking these questions. There's a real concern about this. And I said it yesterday, and kidding aside, this is not like, oh, I'm going to wait to get the next iPhone so all the glitches are backed out. These scientists have been working for decades on coming up with these types of vaccines. But how do you win back the trust of many Americans who have questions about this as a result of the politicization of the vaccination process?
Yeah, I'm so pleased that earlier presidents, Bill Clinton, George Bush, Barack Obama, have all agreed to take this vaccine and take it publicly. I'm hoping that leaders across the country will do that. And I really just want to remind people that, you know, in 1900, the average American white man lived till age 40. And now we live to 78 or 84. It's a big difference because of vaccines.
And even from the broader standpoint, again, if you're just joining us, a red headline crossing the Bloomberg terminal: FDA advisors vote that Pfizer vaccine's benefits outweigh the risk. We're talking with Congressman Don Beyer, a Democrat from Virginia's 8th congressional district. And even in the sense, Congressman, what do you hope lawmakers are going to be able to do to facilitate the rapid and responsible execution of this vaccination effort?
Well, back to your first question about when will the extra stimulus relief come? Because a big piece of that will be, you know, $15 billion or more just for vaccines. And then I'm hoping that we trust our governors and our local county officials to get it to the people who need it most.
And do you think that there needs to be a mass education effort nonpartisan effort to sort of depoliticize this?
I think this would be the most important time for the National Ad Council and everyone with a Twitter account or a Facebook account to weigh in and point out how important this is, especially when we're just about to hit, you know, where we're doing 3,000 deaths a day, more than 9/11, about to cross the 300,000 mark. This vaccine is going to be much safer than living in a non-vaccine world.
All right. Congressman Don Beyer, Democrat representing Virginia's 8th congressional district, the vice chairman of the Joint Economic Committee. Thank you, sir, so much for your time. And again, if you're just joining us, breaking news: Pfizer shot gets nod from FDA advisors as agency decision nears. The first COVID-19 vaccine expected to be deployed in the United States won the backing of a panel government advisors who met Thursday to consider emergency use authorization for the shot. Much more coming up next on this. Complete reaction from Greta Van Susteren and James Homan. You're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.
You're listening to Bloomberg Sound On with Kevin Cirilli on Bloomberg 99.1 and 105.7 FM HD2.
I'm Kevin Cirilli, Chief Washington Correspondent for Bloomberg Television and for Bloomberg Radio. Breaking news, headlines all over my Bloomberg terminal, reporting from Anna Edney. The first COVID-19 vaccine expected to be deployed in the U.S. won the backing of a panel of government advisors who met all day today to consider emergency use authorization for the shot. The FDA advisory panel voted 17-4 with one abstention that the benefits of the Pfizer and BioNTech vaccines outweigh the risks for use in people ages 16 and older. Now, the FDA does not have to follow the recommendation, though often it does agree with its advisors. The vote moves the experimental vaccine closer to authorization, which could happen within days. After gaining clearance, vaccines will be distributed across the U.S. in a massive undertaking that will put healthcare workers and long-term care facility residents at the front of the line. The U.S. expects 2.9 million doses to be available to states immediately. That's where things stand right now. Again, the Pfizer shot has gotten a nod from FDA advisors, moving it one step closer as the entire agency, not just the advisors, now decides whether or not this vaccine will happen. But again, this is a major step forward, a major hurdle cleared right before what would likely become an approval. And again, 2.9 million doses of the Pfizer vaccine, the government is saying that those vaccines would be available almost immediately to frontline workers and to individuals right at the top of and to elder, I'm sorry, to elderly Americans as well, as we've seen unfold this week across the pond in the United Kingdom. James Holman is with me, national political correspondent for The Washington Post and the author of The Daily 202. Greta Van Susteren, chief national political analyst for Gray Media and a host of Full Court Press with Greta Van Susteren, a great program, if I do say so. Greta, I mean, just your reaction to this major, major development on the vaccination front.
Well, I've done more than 40 specials on just this, as many people in the media have. And I'm also older than you and James. I remember when we walked on the moon and what a huge step that was, what a huge advancement. I think the same way to develop this vaccine in 8 months is absolutely incredible. And I tip my hat to all the scientists who've been working 24/7. I realize some people are frightened of it, and, you know, this is, you know, that's their option. I want, you know, as soon as it's available for me, I will do it.
Same.
And I am grateful for it. And I hope a lot of people do take the vaccine. I hope it's safe, because we are really going to need about 70% of the population to take it in order to create that herd immunity. So that we can get rid of this ugly, nasty virus.
Greta, I mean, I think you just captured it so well. I mean, in 8 months, and we've had Republicans and Democrats, and yesterday we had Congresswoman Abigail Spanberger, who, a Democrat from Virginia, and I thought she put it so well when she said that this was a result of science that got the vaccine so quickly. It wasn't a result of cutting corners.
Well, you know what the other interesting thing is I interviewed Dr. Fauci last week. And I asked him, you know, there's been so much political noise about this, whether you wear a mask, not wear a mask, people saying horrible things about Trump, saying great things about Trump. I asked him, did politics in this election this year, electrifying election year, did it get in the way in any way? Did it in any way get in the way of where we are in terms of developing the vaccine? And Dr. Fauci said to me, no, it was noise. It was noise, but, you know, it's incredible what our scientists have done. And he also tipped his hat to the Trump administration, about Operation Warp Speed. And I know this is so wrapped up in politics, but, you know, this is like D-Day almost for Americans. It's like, you know, this is incredible what we're doing. And, you know, I hope that the FDA is right. I'm willing to believe that they are. And I applaud everybody who's been working on this.
Well, I mean, and you look at what the UK has been doing as well, and so they're moving ahead with this. James Holman, I mean, just to get your reaction, again, headline, major red headline crossing the Bloomberg terminal now. Pfizer shot gets nod from FDA advisors as agency decision nears. So a panel of advisors on the FDA have said that the benefits of Pfizer and BioNTech's vaccines outweigh the risk for use in people ages older than 16. I mean, James, this is a major, major, major milestone.
It is, and it's a testament, Kevin, to private enterprise. You know, Pfizer didn't take any government money for research and development of this. It's also a testament to the value in some ways of globalization. You know, the Pfizer was partnered with BioNTech, which is a German company that's run by Turkish immigrants. And the competition, I think, proved really healthy between Pfizer and AstraZeneca and Moderna. And I think it's notable, you know, that we're going to get these doses before, you know, say Canada, where they have socialized medicine and they in many ways have discouraged investment in this kind of R&D. And thank God that these pharmaceutical companies were able to invest in that.
James, can I ask just one question? You know, they didn't take money for R&D, but didn't they take money for 100 million doses? And doesn't that, I mean, can you imagine selling a product where you have someone that's agreeing to buy, you know, 100 million of your doses?
Yes.
So, you know, the taxpayers, you know, the taxpayers, and thank you to the taxpayers for, you know, they didn't really say yes or no, but, you know, the taxpayers are financing a lot of this. Maybe not in the R&D, but we agreed to buy 100 million of all of doses of all these different efforts, and it could have fallen flat. So
I think Pfizer was being a little disingenuous.
Yeah, no, you're right. And to be fair, the government did pay for the R&D as part of Operation Warp Speed for Moderna. And so, yes, government certainly played an important role, too. But I do think that there is a lot to be said for, the technology that allowed for the sprint to get the vaccine, this new RNA way of making vaccines. This is a new way of doing vaccines. It had kind of been percolating and in the pipeline for a decade. That's
well,
how
and,
we
and
were
I got
able
it. And I have to just remind people of that because yes, I mean this happened so quickly in 8 months, but this strand of the virus has been being researched for years. I mean, it's not like they had to invent. So, and I say that with, because I want to. I think that should give people confidence that that this has been researched for years.
Can I throw one thing who I think should go to the front of the line? First, obviously, healthcare workers. But I really would like to see go to the front line if they want it. The thousands and, 30,000 for this, for Moderna, 30,000 for Pfizer, half of them got placebos. And, yeah. And they took a risk. So shouldn't they be able to go sort of the front of the line, the ones who got the placebo, if they want it? Because, they took a far greater risk than the rest of us. They were willing to do it, and they got nothing for it. They got the placebo. I'd like to see some effort to give them the advantage.
Well, hospitals right now are having lottery systems because of the frontline workers and whatnot. But regardless, I mean, again, I know it's really easy and the days are so much shorter. It's dark. It's I get it. Trust me, I get it. But we're here. We are, folks. I mean, a major milestone, a major step achieved. So the light is at the end of the tunnel. The light is coming. But we just gotta, stay diligent, wear the mask, get through this because now the vaccine is on the horizon. So that's what's on my radar. That's what's on everyone's radar. The vaccine is on the horizon. We got a minute left. Gotta go ahead.
Where do you fall on dyeing your hair?
Oh, you heard that. So I don't dye my hair. So I said to Craig Gordon, who's the bureau chief.
Can I tell you? Wait a second. I do dye my hair, let me admit it, but I got to tell you, I've had a lot of male colleagues who also dye their hair, and they deny. You're young, so
I don't dye my hair.
This
is the story, Greta. So Craig Gordon's the bureau chief here. He shows up at the office yesterday, socially distant, has the mask on, and he comes up to me, and he said, "How you been all year?" I said, "Well, look, I'm getting older. I've been here 5 years. I've got gray hairs." And he goes, "Oh, you got to start dyeing it." And now, of course, I got the producers all giving me a hard time. But my thanks to James Homan and Greta. Greta, maybe I'm not going to dye my hair. I'm Greta Van Susteren, the legendary, my friend. Thank you so much for listening. More tomorrow. You're listening to Bloomberg 99.1.